Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
If we want to be creative, we have to think like an alien. We have to imagine that we're coming from a different planet and we're seeing the world fresh as if, you know, we have never seen it before. And that's very much the conditions that are required. If you're trying to be creative, well, we all come with a set of assumptions, a set of principles that we've often evolved from what we've done in the past. And that very much colors the way we think about the problems that need to be solved, the solutions that make sense, the way we look at the future.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com.
Doing creative work can be kind of lonely, and that's why we built the Unmistakable Listener Tribe. The Tribe is a community for professionals to connect and support each other. Everything is designed to help you grow your business and share what's working and what isn't. And that's true whether you're a business owner or an artist. You'll get access to feedback, live conversations with guests, and so much more. By joining the Tribe, you become part of a community of creators who all support each other, and it's completely free. Hopefully I'll see you there. Visit unmistakablecreative.com/tribe to join. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/tribe. Cyril, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Well, thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure to have you here. So as I was saying before we hit record here, I actually got your book, Alien Thinking, quite a while back. And then for some strange reason, on a random drunken night, I picked it up off the living room table and looked at it and thought, wait a minute, this looks really interesting. And I emailed your publicist back and said, yes, I definitely want to talk to you, one of the authors of this book. But before we get into the book, I want to start by asking, where were you born and raised? And how did that end up impacting the choices that you have made throughout your life and your career?
Well, that's actually a very interesting question. I mean, I was born in France, but I quite never lived in France. I've been an immigrant all of my life, believe it or not. And today I think that this probably impacted my interest in terms of looking at creative people and what sort of solutions exist to the problems that we face in this world. So I was raised in New Caledonia, which is, you know, not too far from Australia. And New Zealand. And that was when I was a child. And then I moved to Réunion Island, which is a fantastic place in the middle of the Indian Ocean, close to Madagascar, Mauritius. And what's fantastic about this island is that you have people who came from all corners of the world who are living together in this amazing place that sort of erupted from the ocean. It's a volcanic island. And then I lived there until I was 18, went back to France to do my studies, quickly realized I wanted to live in a different place, moved to Canada, where I spent a few years, did most of my studies, and then in the end decided to come back to Switzerland, where I live now. And you know, when you ask the question, how did this impact, you know, what I do? I think it had an amazing impact, because in fact, you know, I got used to the question of people asking me, so where are you from? You know, you probably picked up from my accent, right? Yeah. I'm not, right, from the place where you know, any place that you can really identify. I mean, obviously I kept my French accent, but you know, it feels uncomfortable at first, but then you realize if you can deal with that uncertainty of being in a place that is not, you know, the one that you've known for a long time, if you if you go over this feeling of being an immigrant, you realize it's quite nice because you get to learn a lot and you realize that people live in places, they face interesting situations always, but they also show different ways of dealing with those situations. And there's really no standard way of doing things. And that's what I learned from all of those places, right? I mean, we all have different ways of living, of working, of cooking. And there's always something you can learn from each place that you go to. Yeah. And probably that again influenced my interest for, you know, how can we bring progress to this world? You know, how can we understand the foundations of creativity? You know, there's a lot of different things you can learn from various places around the world. And that's important if you're trying to be innovative.
Yeah. So I have to ask about the island because when you said that, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Twins. It's a really old Arnold Schwarzenegger movie with him and Danny DeVito. Yeah. And so he, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger ends up being from this, you know, island where he's not been exposed to popular culture. All he's ever had is books. So he ends up being sort of this very intelligent person who's stuck with Danny DeVito as his so-called twin, with the same mother who's just kind of a putz. But what that makes me wonder is when you know, on a place like an island, what is the sort of social structure and social life like? You know, how does being from somewhere that small impact your social relationships? And then as far as sort of, you know, popular culture and what's going on around the world, how much are you exposed to when you're in an island, like living on an island like that? And how does that shape your sort of value systems and beliefs?
Yeah. Well, the first thing is that when you live on an island, you know, you realize that even though it's a small place, you know, Réunion is a volcanic island, so there are people living in the middle of the island, in the mountains, literally, who have never seen the sea, believe it or not. And of course, when you travel on the island, you go into the mountains. I love to hike as a child, as a teenager, and you know, you realize that wow, you know, there are people who are very comfortable, right, living close to their roots, and who don't necessarily have the opportunity to travel and discover what the world has to offer, even though it's only maybe a few hours from where they live. There are people who prefer to live in their mountains and have never had a chance to discover the rest of the island. And obviously, when you live on an island, there's always a danger that you don't get to see something else, right? You have this island fever that we all know about because you feel that you're somehow confined on the island. But what's interesting is that obviously the island is in the middle of the Indian Ocean and you can travel really quickly to other places as well. And then you realize that actually the island was the gathering of several cultures. There are people who came, you know, it was a deserted island. There was an empty island. There was nothing. People populated this island when they arrived from Africa. They arrived from India. They arrived from, you know, all kinds of the Middle East as well. And now they're all sort of sharing, you know, their customs and living in peace. And again, the values that it gave me is that, you know, again, we can live peacefully together. We can all bring a diverse set of views and perspectives. And when you mix all of that and you see it in the food, you see it in the music, you see it in the movie making, you know, there's so much magic that can be created by colliding and mixing cultures, practices, sets of values and belief system as well. They can coexist and they can create a fantastic, you know, set of materials that is required when you try to enjoy life and everything that life can offer.
Yeah. Well, so having grown up like this with this sort of diversity of cultures and this sort of melting pot, despite being on an island, when you see something like what's happened in the United States over the last 4 or 5 years, where we're becoming more and more divided, what do you make of that? When you see that, like, what do you fear are the consequences of that?
Well, interestingly, right? I mean, you live in any country where you have a mix of cultures, there's always a potential, if you will, for beauty, right? I mean, those cultures, when they mix and when they interact with each other, can create the conditions for newness and for great opportunities for learning and rejuvenation and creation. But there's also the potential for clash, right? Where cultures don't really talk to each other, don't really understand each other, don't really mix well with each other. And then you end up with a patchwork of conflicting sets of values and systems. And so every time that you have a diverse nation or a diverse set of cultures that are in coexistence, you have to spend quite a bit of time working on unity, right? And so, you know, you see it in teams, when you have teams of people who, that are made up of individuals who all have their own individual voice and they bring a very peculiar set of expertise and capabilities, and they are trying to work together. They might be very diverse. And so if that's the case, they have a great potential for creativity and innovation and for dealing very effectively with the complex problems that exist. But they also have, you know, a very interesting sort of probability of clashing, because they might end up in situations where they never agree, they never see eye to eye on anything. And so, you know, the team of people who are very diverse get stuck and conflicts arise and people get frustrated and they withdraw their energy from the team. And so, you know, whenever I work with a diverse group of people, you know, we try to leverage the benefits of diversity, but we also spend quite a bit of time trying to build a united team of people. And the same goes for, you know, again, teams in organizations, but also for countries, right? I mean, we should be working on integrating our cultures, integrating our belief systems, integrating our practices, you know, but keeping our individuality, of course. And again, we should build bridges and not walls. That's, you know, the way I like to think about what makes the world beautiful.
Mm. So, you know, I you mentioned earlier that you still have your accent, which kind of made me wonder. And I've asked this version of this question in some way or another to multiple people who are immigrants. When you are exposed to so many cultures and you're moving around so much, how do you preserve aspects of your culture through generations? And I'll, you know, expand on this. So this is something I've realized being an Indian person who has a sister who married a guy who's from a different part of India where we speak different languages. And, you know, at the rate things are going, my parents are like, the likelihood that I'm going to end up with an Indian girl doesn't seem very high. And my first thought is that the first thing to go is going to be language. And, you know, I speak my native language fluently, but even to this day, having been born and brought up in the United States, my parents will speak to me in our native language and I'll reply to them in English.
Yeah.
That's just kind of how it's become. And that's apparently quite common. So I wonder, in your own life, how you've managed to preserve culture and heritage, despite having gone, you know, and lived in all these different places.
Yeah. So obviously, I mean, you know, it's a very interesting question, right? You have to stay true to who you are first. I mean, I really believe that, you know, again, you come to a place that is made up of very different, you know, sets of you know, principles and you can bring something that is very special, very unique to it. And so you've got to believe in your individuality and what is it that you can bring to a team, to an organization, to a country, right? When you come from somewhere else. And that's a very special voice. And you have to believe in that and try to preserve it as you mentioned, because there's always a risk, right? That you end up being like a virus, right? You arrive in a new environment and the new environment is made up of a certain set of principles and your different way of thinking, your different way of living, your different way of doing things might be perceived as a risk for that system that exists. And so like any virus, you might get rejected, right? I mean, people might perceive you as the alien. People might perceive you as somebody who is clashing with established norm that is prevalent in a given society. And so like a virus, you might be rejected. But you might also get infected, right? Yourself, right? I mean, you know, the system will try to absorb you. So if they don't reject you, they will try to make you look more like the other people, right? Who are there and who are trying to represent a certain view of how the world works. And so, as you mentioned, it's very important to preserve who you are so that you can continue to bring, right, your individual voice. But also you should adapt somehow so that you're not perceived as totally alien and totally clashing with the systems of beliefs that are in place. So how can you preserve yourself, but also mix, you know, nicely with the system, the way it exists? And you know, when I go to my own personal life, sweetie, I mean, I ended up marrying a person who was Canadian, but was also, you know, coming from different sets of cultures. My father was from India, our mother was from Trinidad and Tobago. And of course, our kids were raised in you know, in a very global, eclectic, you know, type of environment. And I always spoke French to my kids at home. And my wife, we are not separated, but my wife at the time always decided to speak English to them. And so we, you know, and at the table, at the dinner table, we could switch easily from French to English, but they were raised in a perfectly bilingual environment. They went to bilingual school. And, yeah. And for us, it was important, you know, symbolically, right, that we wanted to preserve, you know, this part of who we were, right? And the language is important. And I see other colleagues and other friends who've made a different choice. You know, they decided for simplicity and practicality reasons to just have one language in the home. And to me, I've always felt that somehow maybe we were missing out on an opportunity to share a part of us that is important, right? And in the end, yeah. My mother tongue was French, and I wanted to make sure that my kids, you know, would have access to that language, you know, from the moment they were born. And the same thing went on, you know, for my wife and English.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I very distinctly remember I grew up in Edmonton, Alberta for about 4 years. And I remember in elementary school, we had classes that were in French and classes that were in English. And I always wondered to this day why my parents didn't put me in the French class, because as you probably know, it's so much easier to learn a language when you're a kid. Somehow you just pick it up without even trying.
Yeah, for sure.
So you leave the island. What has been the trajectory of your career that has led you to the point where you're writing this book and doing the work that you do after leaving the island?
Well, listen, you know, I left the island. I was 17, went to France, you know, decided to go to university over there, and then quickly realized that, in fact, you know, I wanted to continue to discover the world. And I quite didn't fit in France, right? I mean, I didn't speak like the Parisians. I didn't dress like them. And in fact, there was an exchange program with the University of Ottawa in Canada. And I just decided to go for it and then discover the culture. In fact, in Canada, that was very welcoming and allowed me to do exactly what you were saying, you know, preserve who you are. Bring it to the country because that's what makes Canada actually beautiful is this gathering of different cultures, and then essentially I was still a French citizen, and at some point I had to do my military service. Realized that you know I could do it as a civil service. Decided to become a teacher in Canada for a couple of years, and then realized I loved it, right? And so decided to go back to school, and after a few years. Join IMD. IMD is here in Switzerland. Is a very special place. It's a business school that is one of the leading business schools in the world. But it was founded by business executives for business executives, and so it's a place that gives me the opportunity to work with real people. So I work with senior executives working in large multinational corporations, but I also work with small startups who are trying to somehow bring you know new value to the world. And, you know, every time, every day when I go to work, I have the opportunity for conversations with people who are trying to reinvent who they are, what they do. And over the years, I've learned a great deal about what makes certain people, certain organizations successful, what makes them able to think differently about the world in which we live, identify important, meaningful problems that need to be solved, but also be creative in the kinds of solutions that they bring to the world. And so I've seen a lot of willingness to reinvent what we do, but I've seen interesting journeys with sometimes great successes, but also in other occasions, frustrations. And you learn from all of those experiences. And that's what we try to bring in the book.
Yeah. So two questions. You know, we talk when anytime you go to a new place, they talk about this whole idea of culture shock. And I wonder when you come from, you know, the island to France to Canada, when you get to Canada, what aspects of the culture shocked you?
When I came from France to Canada, I remember, you know, I mean, you know, one of the big things when you arrive is like all those student clubs, you know, that you discover. And, you know, so I was doing my MBA in Canada, and literally on the first day, you get introduced to all the clubs that you could participate to, and then I remember the first people I ended up talking to were absolutely wonderful individuals, a club of the you know sort of gay and lesbians and transgender, and I felt wow, this is amazing, because I could never imagine, and at the time, I mean it was you know 30 years ago or 20 years ago rather, and I couldn't imagine that you know this could be possible in a country like France, who was much more traditional, and you know in France you would expect to see the sports clubs and the chess clubs, but here you know very much part of the conversation was a club that was trying to advance you know conversations on a very important societal topic, and it was part of the university life, and I felt yeah you know there's something I'm going to learn in this place that maybe. Would have not been possible yet, you know, in France. I think since then, you know, we've advanced in many other countries around the world. But that's one of my first few vivid images that I remembered, you know, from arriving in Canada and discovering, you know, what does student look like, what does student life looks like, you know, and what sort of conversations can you have when you're trying to think about your place in society.
Well, I mean, speaking of student life, I knew, you know, with you being a professor, as any academic who comes to my show has to deal with, there's no way we're going to get out of this without talking about education reform. Because in the United States, and you probably are somewhat familiar with this, students here are often riddled with mountains of debt. And, you know, I've even said, you mentioned, you know, you're at a business school that was created for executives by executives. I went to an MBA program that I described as an $80,000 surf lesson at Pepperdine. And I said, you know, I got out of this school and I realized that, you know, going to business school teaches you nothing about running a business. And that's the conclusion I drew from my own MBA, but you're a professor, which, you know, makes you far more credible than I am in this circumstance. And I wonder, when you look at the contrast in terms of education where you're at versus what you've seen around the world, what are the differences? And if you were put in charge of reforming the education system in the United States, which I realize is an insane question that, you know, I'm expecting you to answer, you know, in less than 5 minutes, what would you do? What would you do differently to fix the things that are wrong?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, and at which level, right? I mean, I think one of the most sort of impactful TED Talks of all times, you know, is around what's wrong with the school system, and it happens to be in the UK, and at least what was described, and how is it that schools from a very young age, right, doing things that might be killing the imagination and the creativity of kids, right? Because we socialize people from a very young age into the right way of doing things, right? And there are certain standards that need to be achieved, and there's certain ways of behaving, and who are we to say often, right? So from a very young age, we kind of teach people, you know, what they should aspire to, you know, what does a good practice look like? And in the process, we also discourage deviant behavior, right? Or actually different behavior. And we discourage kids from continuing to express their creativity. And so I think my first level of interest, if you will, would be around what is happening in schools, and you know, are we only emphasizing the academic sort of topics and credentials, or are we creating possibilities for kids to be well-rounded, you know, individuals with who have a chance to explore and develop their character, who have a chance to develop their appreciation for nature, for the arts, for essentially all the dimensions that are important to achieving happiness in their lives and contribute to the progress of society and not just business. And so that would be the first thing. Now, of course, when you get, you know, to continue on this education journey and you become a teenager and an adult and you go to university, there's a lot of things that could be changed, right? And you mentioned the fact that US universities, but this is also becoming the norm in many other countries, are very expensive. And so what is it that we do to provide opportunities for individuals who are very talented and who are not coming from very rich families to have access to the best learning possibilities that exist? And here, when you think about it, I mean, all those universities are funded by, you know, very wealthy donors, and obviously, you know, where is the money going to? And so sometimes it is going to research, which I think is very, very important. It is also going to, you know, to the professors and attracting the best talent from around the world. But it is also, you know, going maybe sometimes in endowments. You know, it's those reserves that universities continue to accumulate. And sometimes you wonder, what is the purpose of those reserves, you know? And there's certainly a lot more that we could do to make sure that the companies that contribute funds to the functioning of universities are also creating opportunities for the less wealthy individuals to have the right for this education that is very special. But, you know, sometimes we think that the answer for this is for governments to provide, you know, free access to education. And some countries have been successful with those models, and other countries less so. Right? So if you go back to the case of France, right, you really have a two-tier system, unfortunately, and you've got a lot of universities that are free, and you look at their classrooms and they are crowded, and the professors have very few budgets to be able to realize their full potential. And then you have the elite schools, very very rich, but also very expensive. So, yeah, you know, there's certainly a lot of things that could be changed, but that requires, you know, new types of conversations between the government, between the companies that are contributing funds to the functioning of universities and from universities themselves. So it's about, wow, you know, creating the right conditions for success for everyone involved.
Yeah. Well, I think that makes a perfect segue into talking about the book. First off, how did you even come up with this framework of alien thinking?
Well, this was, again, interesting. I mean, I had one of my colleagues, who is actually also a professor in Canada, is just teaching at McGill University, and her name is Estelle Métayer, and she was, sort of teaching a session in one of my programs, and she did it a few times around overcoming biases and again looking at the world with new eyes, and in fact her inspiration was also based on a book that was called Future Think, which is a book that was written by a futurist, Edith Wiener, and they had a chapter, just a little chapter at the beginning of the book, that was called Looking at the World with Alien Eyes. And I thought this was a great metaphor, right? That if we want to be creative, we have to think like an alien. We have to imagine that we're coming from a different planet and we're seeing the world fresh, as if, we have never seen it before. And that's very much the conditions that are required if you're trying to be creative. Well, we all come with a set of assumptions, a set of principles that we've often evolved from what we've done in the past. And that very much colors the way we think about the problems that need to be solved, the solutions that make sense, the way we look at the future, right? If you're an accountant, you see the world in a certain way. If you're coming in from marketing, you see the world in a different way. If you're an expert in a given field, they will provide you with a lens from which you will derive all the truths that you're willing to endorse. And if we want to be creative, again, we have to build multiple lenses into our reasoning and our making sense of the world. And the best way to be able to do that is to really force ourselves to think more like an alien would. You see the world, as if it was, like if, it was the first time that you ever had a chance to experience it. Now, the metaphor is powerful also in another way. Is when you're an alien, when you're creative, you come into the world and it's a very dangerous place, right? I mean, you don't fit, you come up with different ideas, you don't fit, people will look at you with suspicious eyes. And think about the movies you've seen, right? Srini, how often does it end up pretty well, for the aliens in the movie?
Except for E.T.
Except for E.T., but even he has to kind of like escape a few difficult situations, right? And so that was a great metaphor, right, for us. But it's a little bit like saying, well, you've got to think like an immigrant, or you've got to think like a child. You don't know yet. You think you know, but you don't know. And that's not very useful. It's also like to think like you have to think outside of the box, right? You have to escape the prevailing logic. You have to fight orthodoxies. But how do you do that, Srini? Like, how do you do that? And this is where beyond the metaphor, we also use the metaphor to provide a very useful set of techniques that people can actually apply from any sphere of life. So whether you're working in the government, or you're working in a company, or you're working in the hospital, or you're an independent entrepreneur, or you're a writer, or you're an artist, what is it that we can learn from pioneering thinkers and change makers in terms of how they approach the world and how they become creative? Well, we've studied quite a few, and we come up with a set of strategies. And that's why ALIEN is also an acronym. It's a word that stands up for five lenses. And so, the A means something, and so on. And each letter is essentially a letter that represents a part of the mindset that you need to embrace, and a set of strategies that you can use to foster by this particular take on the world. And that's what we go through in the book.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Yeah. Well, let's get into those because I think that was my favorite thing about it is the fact that you took that acronym and you created this just brilliant framework for how to look at this. And let's start with attention because it's funny. All the conversations that we've had about attention here on Unmistakable Creative have typically centered around managing your attention and dealing with distractions. But I think what I appreciated about this is that you had a very different take on this. It was a sort of new idea. When we're talking about attention, and you say when we turn our attention towards something, we must necessarily turn it away from something else. Because attention is a selective activity, we must choose where and what to focus. The attention allocation directs how individuals and organizations interact with the external environment. It determines which stimuli they notice and which they look at. And then you go into these concepts of zooming in and zooming out. So can you expand on that and talk about how it affects our work?
Sure. You know, and again, we tend to zoom in often, right? When we are leaders and or we are creative people, we actually immediately zoom in on some aspects of a situation that we think is interesting, right? There are people we talk to that give us insight, and then immediately we sort of zoom in. We focus our attention, we focus our time, we focus our effort, right, on a certain type of phenomenon that we think we can explore, that we can change, that we can improve. And that's important. We have to be able to do that, right? But you know, the problem is that we might be looking at the wrong thing, right? I mean, we might be zooming on the wrong set of people, the wrong set of issues, and we might be solving a problem that doesn't need to be solved or that is ill-formulated, if you will, and that will lead us in directions that are not, you know, very productive for the type of progress that we want to bring to the world. And so we have to be able to zoom out. We have to be able to see the whole sort of system, if you will, and consider multiple lenses of stakeholders that could inform the way we make sense of the world that we live in. And so we have to see the forest and not just the trees. But we also have to switch focus. And I'll give you an example, because even if we do that, right? So I take my MBA students every year and we try to improve the way we make sense of the hospital, right? And you know, if we are trying to improve the patient experience, you get admitted to the hospital, and there's all kinds of things that could go wrong, right? And so we might zoom in, we might have privileged conversations with the nurse that will tell us, you know, her own reality on what is happening and what is problematic for patients, and we zoom in on that. But unless we talk to a multiple set of stakeholders, right, we won't really understand what can be done. So we need to talk to the hospital administrators. We need to talk to the doctors. We need to talk to the patients themselves. We need to talk to the families of the patients. You know, there's all kinds of stakeholders. So again, zooming in, but also zooming out, right? Look at the world from multiple lenses. And then often you also need to switch focus, because even if you zoom out, you're often still biased. You're still looking at the wrong system, if you will. And I'll give you an example, and I'll choose a different example to illustrate the point. You know, there's a story that we tell in the book about Kellogg, right? So I don't know if you like cereals or if you have kids who like cereals, right?
Yeah.
But you know, one problem with cereals is that often there are plenty of sugar and they are not so healthy. So they were trying to come up with a better food diet for kids, but also one that they would be able to bring to school and enjoy at school for those kids who don't necessarily want to, you know, to have a lunch provided by the school. So how do you do that? And so again, they zoomed in, you know, on the current practices and what is it that families do and so on. And they zoomed out. They talked to nutritionists and they talked to the teachers themselves to have their view on, you know, what could be done. They talked to the, you know, to pediatricians and so on. And then they realized, well, you know, they were not getting anything really new, really interesting, until one person said, well, what if we talk to the janitors? The janitors, you know, the people cleaning the school premises. And, you know, this is interesting because it turns out that the janitors, you know, see all kinds of things that everybody else ignores, right? So they are, you know, sort of present in the school corridors. You know, they see the kind of chats that are going on between the kids. They are there also during school recess. They see what food items get traded, you know, on the school black market. They see what food items end up in the bin. So the parents put them in the bag thinking the kids are enjoying, you know, some nice healthy snacks, you know, but in fact, you know, those are kind of being fawned upon by the kids themselves, and they just throw them in the bins, never tell the parents. But the school janitors see that. They see what creates excitement. They see also, you know, what is not appreciated by a group of social beings at this very young age. And this is when they started to get real insights that they had not heard from the experts, so to speak. So not only you need to zoom in, there are specific categories of people that you need to spend privileged time with because they have core insights on the phenomenon you're trying to change. You have to zoom out, and often you've got to switch focus, right? So if you go back to the hospital example I was giving you earlier, you could probably still talk to the janitors, but you could also, if you're trying to improve, you know, the experience of patients at the hospital, you could also go to their homes, because in fact, one day, right, they will not be at the hospital. And so the best insights maybe you get from other settings than the hospital. Switch focus and you might see the light. Okay, so wow. That's for attention. Right. Switch your focus to levitation. See the world from different angles. Yeah. And okay, so levitation, the L. Sorry. So the L stands for levitation. And as you can imagine, you know, if you do what I've just described around paying attention to the world in all kinds of new and interesting ways, it can become overwhelming. And often, you know, as creative people, we neglect, you know, the importance the importance of taking time off and timeouts and creating the space for you to stop doing what it is that you're doing and in fact gain perspective and enrich your understanding. And if you look at all the high performers in any discipline and the people who are performing, but also finding ways to continuously reinvent themselves, they do take timeouts as they do in sports. You know, when things don't work out, stop what you're doing, reflect on what is working, what is not working so well, and give yourself a chance to do something else, right? Something new. But often in big companies or in various aspects of our lives, we are so busy. We're just going on to the next activity, to the next task, but we don't take timeouts. We don't say, okay, you know, this is not really working out. Let me just disconnect. You know, let me take a little walk, you know, a 30-minute walk. Let me think about what it is that I'm doing. I might come back and be more creative, right, in the resolution of the problems I'm trying to solve. But also take time off. I mean, sometimes we need time off to actually recharge our batteries. And you know, we tell the story of Adrien Ferrat, the chef who created El Bulli, one of the restaurants that was voted the number one restaurant in the world for 5 years in a row. He used to close his restaurant 6 months every year. 6 months every year. Because he said, the kind of world that we live in doesn't give me the space I need, right, to remain creative. So obviously very few of us can go to our boss in the organizations we work for and say, you want me to be creative? I need 6 months sabbatical every year. But the point is you need space, right? And all the very creative ideas that we see often have taken a long time to incubate, to germinate. So we can't just order creativity for the next 6 months. We can't just expect a team to come up with a very, you know, innovative concept in 3 weeks or in 6 months. Often, right, those ideas that are very creative take time to incubate, to germinate, and we've got to be able to be comfortable, right, with longer time frames if we try to change the paradigm that we operate in. And organizations are not very comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's for levitation. But interestingly,
I did have a question about levitation, actually, that you brought up. You talked about the echo chamber effect, where you said technologies can also create an echo chamber effect that buffers you from novel sources of ideas because the notifications you opt to receive are tailored to your interest. You discard the creative freedom that comes with browsing. How do people stop doing that? Because to your point, I saw this when I started watching Trevor Noah on YouTube. And next thing I know, all my recommendations were Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert, pretty much everybody who would basically fall into the category of being on the left.
Yeah. So you're completely right, right? I mean, we live in a world where the shows we watch on Netflix are customized to our taste. Every application that we use on our mobiles is essentially trying to code, what is it that we're interested in and tries to provide content that fits, with what we want to see. And that is working against us when we are trying to be creative, where we need serendipity. We need to be exposed to ideas that we would have never come across otherwise, right? So we need to fight this, right? And indeed, that's the problem with digital tools. They're so efficient, right, that they bring the information we need at our fingertips. But sometimes, right, to come up with better solutions to the problems we face, we don't know what information we need, right? The learnings can come from anywhere. and topics that we would have never explored, if we had been rational about them. And so we need to fight that. And the simple things that we can do, right? I mean, it's still okay, to go to the library and just stroll through the books, without any purpose in mind, and then just pick, a book randomly and say, I'm going to read this, and maybe I might learn something in this. That so, of course, it requires a little bit of time. But it might be an investment in your creativity. It's okay to go to a conference that has nothing to do with your field of inquiry, right? Mm. You might see a speaker talking about a topic that, again, is very different from your own, but the way that speaker is making sense of the world might give you an inspiration that will find its way into your own context and make you very creative, right?
Yeah.
We say innovators steal with pride. Right, innovators don't have, eureka moments where they think about concepts that had never been envisioned before. They notice interesting things that come in very different horizons than their own, and they find a way to bring them and bore them and add on to them. They steer with pride, and that's what serendipity can give you.
Well, it's funny you say that, because one of the things that I make a point to do, because I know how Amazon works, particularly because I read a lot of books, is I will go to the bookstore because there I will discover things that I would have never thought about reading. Whereas on Amazon, I'm going to get things recommended to me based on all my previous purchases.
That's right. That's right. So invest in serendipity, right? Be humble. Go there, give yourself a chance to explore. And exactly as you do, you go to the bookstore. And you just see what's out there, right? You talk to your friends. I constantly ask my friends, what are some of the books you've read lately that really, brought you some nice, interesting surprise? And maybe there's something you can learn from that as well, right? And you don't exactly know what it is when you start, but give yourself a chance to explore.
Yeah. So you open the section on imagination by saying alien thinking avoids cognitive biases. It prompts imaginative leaps by rejecting default responses and exploring novel alternatives. And I think this is what probably made me really like the book, was the fact that you talked about cognitive biases, because this is something I've been thinking a lot about over the last year or two. Even when I create my own content, I realize I'm doing it from a somewhat biased perspective. And I learned this actually from a woman who was in one of our programs. I talked about productivity, and I realized I'm giving productivity advice based on the fact that I am a single guy who has more time than she probably does. And she would show up to our weekly Zoom calls with a baby. And I realized, I was like, okay, in the context of her life, my advice is potentially bullshit.
You know, it's interesting. It's never bullshit, right? I mean, but you know, for us, imagination, again, there's nothing magical about it, right? It's you know, sometimes we have this idea that there's the creative type and they are the rest of us, right? Or there's the very imaginative people, as if they have, again, a unique innate capability to be imaginative. And you know, we can even test for imagination with personality. And I hate this idea. I think all of us are imaginative. The kids are very imaginative, right? Because they play. They play with ideas. They don't have a very sort of developed hypothesis at the start, right? They don't exactly know. They're only there to learn, right? So they experiment with ideas. They play with ideas. They put things together in new and interesting ways. And then they find their way, right, into the future. And that's what imagination is all about, right? And there's plenty of examples of people, again, who've taken their inspiration from all kinds of domains that had nothing to do with their own and ended up being very creative. So, you know, we talk about the example lately of Radia Perlman. I don't know if you know her. She's a legend in tech circles. She's actually the woman who brought the internet to life, believe it or not. Right? She was the inventor of those protocols, the STP protocols that help people communicate across interconnected corporate networks. So you've got, you know, computers that are talking to each other on the internet these days. But there used to be a time when, in fact, you know, companies had computers, they had corporate networks that were very private, right? I mean, they did not want any information to leak on the outside because it was supposed to not be very secure. And in fact, Radia, you know, is the woman who essentially created, right, the protocols to orchestrate the communications across those computers, you know, between the walls of corporations. And where did she get her inspiration? From nature, right? And from the image of a tree in particular. So she was not a techie, right? But she observed nature and she looked at how trees were interconnected and somehow she managed to bring that inspiration to the world of computing and to create the conditions for the internet, right, to arrive. And for us, connecting the dots, so in this case with nature and computers, is what imagination is all about. And there's a very similar example that we tell in the book, and this is the story of Van Phillips. And Van Phillips is a young gentleman who had lost his lower leg in a water skiing accident. And he was so dissatisfied with the performance of the limbs that the doctors like sort of gave him after the accident that he decided to design his own. And basically what he realized is that the doctors at the time and the prosthetic doctors, you know, wanted to give him a leg that looked like a leg, like a human leg. But he realized that in fact, that was not the point. You know, what he needed was a leg that functioned like a leg, even though it didn't look like a leg. And so he approached the problem from a very different perspective. And he ended up being very imaginative because he drew his inspiration from diving boards, believe it or not, but also the wild cheetah. And he's like, you know, what is it that I can learn from a diving board and from the wild cheetah? And he made connections between the elasticity of the tendons in the wild cheetah and the resistance of the diving board. And he basically created the famous prosthetic limb that powered, and maybe you know that, Oscar Pistorius, right, to succeed as a professional sprinter. But you know, if you look at the at that sort of invention, it has nothing to do with, you know, how we thought about prosthetic limbs, you know, in the past. And again, he drew his inspiration from nature and from objects that are nothing, you know, that had never found their way to the medical field, if you will. And that's what really we believe is the power of imagination. Don't assume you know where your inspiration is going to come from and try to make links across domains that have nothing to do with each other. Often, this is how great creativity is going to emerge.
Wow. So Let's talk about experimentation. I think what struck me about this was something that you said. You say experimentation is the process of turning a promising idea into a workable solution that addresses a real need. The top reasons that startups fail, according to startup founders, is that they offer something nobody wants. Therefore, to establish whether an idea is desirable and viable, you must engage in experimentation. Just as important, experimentation is an essential tool for exploring your options and testing your assumptions. But I think what struck me most was you make this distinction between how alien thinkers conduct experiments and the scientific method. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Because indeed, we spend quite a bit of time running experiments at IMD and with the organizations we work with. But often we realize that the way we run experimentation in organizations is totally wrong, because in fact, we are too attached to the scientific method, right? And again, the scientific method is very powerful, and it tells us you develop a theory on any given, you know, sort of subject, and then you need to look for evidence, right? That is going to either validate your assumptions, right, or invalidate your findings, and then will help you to evolve that theory. And that sounds great in practice, but you know, when you bring it to the world of organizations and you bring it to the world of us, right, as individuals trying to be creative, this is how the scientific method gets implemented. I'll give you another version. Well, I have an hypothesis, and now I'm going to look for evidence, right, that will tell me if this hypothesis is right or if it needs to evolve. The problem is that when we look for evidence, right, we are often just trying to find, and in fact, we see only the evidence that is going to support the initial theory that we have developed. And you know, we all do this. I mean, I was a PhD student in Canada, and I developed a set of hypotheses that I presented to a jury of professors. And the only way I could get my PhD is if I found data that supported the hypothesis. If I just find data that contradicts my hypothesis, they will tell me to go back and study more. So and the same goes, you know, we are trying to be creative in organizations. We are expected to succeed. And so we develop a set of assumptions around a new product, a new service, a new solution that meets customer needs in new ways. And then, of course, we are testing, right, those ideas. But the only thing we want to find is data that confirms that we are right. Yeah. We are there to prove, not to improve. and that's the problem. And one executive I worked with told me, if you torture the data long enough, Srini, it will confess. And that's what we do. When instead, yeah, we should be letting the data speak. And so sometimes we don't need an hypothesis, right? We don't need an hypothesis. We could just look at data and see all kinds of things that are interesting and derive a theory from it, right? And we often don't do that. We think it's wrong, right? But we have to be able to play with ideas without a clear hypothesis at the start and see how the future unfolds as we see it, right? Mm-hmm. Without always a clear hypothesis at the start. So that's what we try to explain and how to do that in the book as well.
Yeah. So when you get to navigation, you say successful navigation starts with preparation. To respond appropriately to threats and opportunities on the spot, you need to be physically and mentally prepared. And then you say something, I think that this is what I really wanted to ask you about. You said whether working independently or within an organization, innovators often delude themselves in two ways. They overestimate the ability of their breakthrough solution to speak for itself and succeed on its own merits. They fall to prey to the "if you build it, they will come" fallacy. Second, they underestimate the potential hostility of the environment. How do you actually avoid both of those?
Yeah. You know, that's for us, you know, probably one of the most important aspects of the book, and one that is often neglected by people who are creative, right? And because you are creative, because you have identified a better way potentially of solving problems that exist in this world, that you emphasize that, right? I mean, you go and you meet people and you engage all kinds of stakeholders and you focus on what makes your solution disruptive, what makes your solution better than what exists already out there. And of course, we've spent so much time perfecting, developing those ideas that we've fallen in love with them. And we somehow expect that everybody will kind of welcome us with open arms and say, "Thank God, you know, you've arrived." And, you know, that solution doesn't speak for itself. In fact, that disruptive solution is going to clash with a number of belief systems that exist. And so disruptive innovators need to work extremely hard to just explain, you know, why their solution has merit, even though it's perceived to be so different from everything that, that exists out there and that we've experimented with in the past, because it's not obvious, right? And we also have to take special measures to engage people in our vision, because often there are people who are there to protect the status quo, right? For good reasons, because again, you come up with a different practice. Is it really going to bring progress, or is it going to disrupt what is there and is somehow working, right? And we're never quite sure at the start. And so that's why in case of a doubt, when you see a new practice, should it? Because it might be a virus, right? That is going to be disturbing. So there's plenty of examples, right, in the book that we describe. And there are ways you can deal with those situations, right? One example is James Dyson, right? And, you know, of course, he worked and he perfected a system of you know, bagless sort of vacuum cleaner. And initially, he just wanted to sell that concept, right, to the big vacuum manufacturers. And so he approached them and said, voila, look at this. You know, you can have a bagless vacuum cleaner. How neat is this? And of course, he was met with a great level of skepticism, because for them, you know, it totally clashed with their business model that was in place. You know, no more bags to sell. You know, and Steve Sasson, the inventor of the first digital camera at Kodak, made the exact same mistake. He developed the first digital camera, presented it to the senior executives at Kodak, and said, ladies and gentlemen, this is filmless photography. And the moment you do that, you clash with all the belief systems of executives who spend their whole career trying to build a company that would be the leader and that would be extremely proud of the success it had on the processing of film. And so if you propose a filmless paradigm, you're clashing with everything that people actually believe in. So maybe it is a new technology for the future, but you've got to work hard. And there are very simple things that you can do, Sweeney. So in fact, it took him a few years, go back to the Steve Sasson example, to evolve the language to digital film. And the moment you talk about digital film, you show how you relate to who you are as an organization and what makes this company special and the roots of what has made this company successful in the past. And so it's digital film. It's just a new way of doing what we know is important. And that is often a better way of engaging people than saying, whatever you've done in the past is irrelevant, is obsolete. And look at me, I'm so smart, I came up with a better way of doing things. So we've got to find the right balance. We've got to emphasize the disruptive nature of the ideas that we bring that can be better in many ways. But we've got to wrap those disruptive concepts in a language that will resonate with people, that they are willing to embrace, that they are willing to support. One of the great inspiring executives that I worked with in the past, Jean-Paul Bailly, is the former CEO of French La Poste. And the Post, like many other post organizations around the world, was getting disrupted by digital in many important ways. And he said, you've got to change so that you can stay yourself. All organizations exist for a reason. They have a vision of who they are. What is it that they do that is important? And when you bring a creative idea, you have to show the link to this DNA, if you will. And if you can do that, you can engage people and have much better conversations around the disruptive nature of what you do. But often innovators neglect that, and they clash very violently with established system of beliefs that exist, and then they get rejected.
Yeah. So, you know, one thing you say when you get into the section on alien thinking in action, and this really struck me, you said alien thinking is not something you do at a particular time in a dedicated space with clear rules and staple props like whiteboards and sticky notes. It's not a set of gimmicks, but a mindset change to achieve creativity and turn ideas into solutions. Alien thinking is something you can call on at any time whenever you hit a roadblock. It's something you have on tap when needed. And I loved that you've said that, because I think the tendency for anybody who, you know, is a knowledge worker, anybody who is a creative, when they see mental models like this, and I know this because this is my own tendency, they will tend to go into, okay, how do I follow this, you know, sort of step-by-step approach to get the results that Cyril is saying I can get?
Yeah.
And yet I love the fact that you looked at it much more as a mindset as opposed to a series of tactics. But how do people get out of that sort of map-seeking mentality of, hey, give me the formula, give me the steps, and I'll just follow them, to, wait a minute, I need to basically take this and treat it as a compass and you know, come up with my own interpretation.
Yeah. You know, and that's the whole point. And I think, frankly, Sweeney, that's why we wrote the book, because we were getting increasingly frustrated with the way people try to implement, you know, design thinking and lean startup principles in organizations. I mean, I'm a big fan of design thinking. I'm a big fan of the lean startup, but often the way people implement those lenses in organizations is wrong. And because they fall into the trap of, you know, following a neat series of steps, and they fill out a few templates. And of course, they say, I need those beanbag chairs and I need a stack of post-it notes. And somehow it's all innovation theater, right? They give themselves the impression that they are being creative because they follow a series of steps or they fill out templates. But in fact, they are not, because they are missing the essence of what it means to be creative and what it means to see the world in a new light, and what it means to create those connections that we've talked about across very different, you know, sort of domains of inquiry, and to give yourself a chance to experiment with ideas and give yourself a chance to engage people in new types of conversations and build support for the concepts that you've created. And so it is a mindset that doesn't necessarily require a very nice sequence of steps. And, you know, most of the creative people that I've met, they don't have like a nice series of steps that they are following. They just do it their own way, right? I mean, they just do it their own way. But, you know, it's interesting that whatever they do, they actually embrace, right? We fundamentally believe, and that's why we have so many interesting stories in the book, the principles that we're describing. And so whatever it is that you do, are you asking yourself the right questions, right? Are you, you know, considering the world from multiple lenses? Are you giving yourself a chance to pause and reflect, or are you just chasing the next impossible dream all the time and diluting yourself in the process, right? You know, are you making those connections between domains that have nothing to do with each other, playing with ideas like a kid would do? Are you experimenting really to improve and not just to prove that you're correct, right? Are you navigating all the forces that can support or block your progress, right? And if you ask yourself those kinds of questions, and there are things that you can do to give yourself a chance to embrace those questions and integrate them into your day-to-day practice, then you will end up being creative regardless of the process and the steps that you follow.
Wow. Well, I have absolutely loved talking to you. I think that this has just been a really just eye-opening, insightful conversation. I love this book because it really teaches you to question your own assumptions and then think differently, which I love. So I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews at The Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
tell me, Sweeney.
So it's funny because people have answered this question in different ways. And of course, when you write a book called Unmistakable, you have to define it. And I have always defined it as doing something that is so distinctive that nobody else could do it but you in the way that you do it.
Well, you know, and it's interesting because when you asked me that question, I thought about the French expression, which is je ne sais quoi. And I don't know if you've heard it, but
I have.
You know, we are all beautiful, and you know, it doesn't matter, you know, who you are, how you look, what you do. We are all beautiful and we can all bring something very special to this world. But where things tend to go wrong is when we lose that sense of individuality, which, you know, the French refer to the expression je ne sais quoi, that there's something quite interesting about each one of us. And you know, we have to spend some time to think about what that is, right? And what is this you know, unmistakably creative part of us, right? That we have to find out. And if we can preserve that, if we can preserve that sense of individuality, you know, then we can bring it to everything that we do, and we can make the world, and it can be a small part of it, more beautiful and more interesting for all of us to enjoy.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and sharing your story and insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, the book, and everything else that you're up to?
Well, in fact, we put up a website that is called alienthinking.org. And I really encourage everybody to take a look at the website, because we post a number of stories that we've written, very current stories of individuals, and especially women leaders also that that we've met, that we've enjoyed spending time with, that are very alien in their approach to the world. And I really hope that you can find inspiration in those stories. Very soon, there'll be also a little diagnostic tool that you can take. In fact, is going to be up in the next few days. And so you can put yourself to the test. You know, there's a few questions that you can answer and you can see what are some aspects of your mindset that you can work on, and we'll provide you with a tailored set of recommendations that you can follow. And all of this is accessible on the website. And so alienthinking.org, we want to maintain it and make it a place that you like. So, you know, feel free to visit it. And there's even a contact form. So if you want to get in touch with us through the website, you know, we'll be delighted to chat.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch. The skills that are essential for standing out and thriving, no matter how much technology evolved. We're talking about real differentiators here, like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this, AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.